sorts of different things. And living in a society defines your realization of the inward values through the ethics of the society. That's the trick, I might say, of being alive in the world.
But when we look at our contemporary life and look at our institutions in contemporary life, it's very rare that we hear things like, or deal with principles like integrity, ethics, life of the spirit. I mean, if we looked at every bill that comes up before Congress and gets passed and looked at it in terms of its ethical nature or its ethical consequences, I mean, what a different light that would cast on the passage of laws in our government. I mean, the thing is, it seems to be mostly missing from our institutions wherever you look.
Well, you know, one of the problems, I think, in modern life is the rapidity with which social values change. And they change inevitably because the life conditions change. And so there's a lag, and one doesn't know how to evaluate certain things in terms of the contemporary conditions. But politics has to deal with the contemporary moment, and so there you are. You're up against a blank wall. It's almost like a creative world that we were talking about. It's the adventure. As I said somewhere sometime, we are in a free fall into future. You know, the society itself is on the adventure. Mm-hmm. And so it's awfully hard to evaluate situations. Now, what has happened in this country in the past 30 or 40 years with immigrations of people from totally unforeseen places, you know, with totally different life values from those of the people who, let's say, instituted this country. The people who instituted this country can no longer hold on with confidence to their system, which worked, let's say, do you see? But it's got to open now to other things. I'm living in Hawaii. I think the majority of the people in Hawaii are not Christians. There are a lot of Japanese, a lot of Chinese, a lot of, well, the Filipino frequently are Catholic also. But the saying, "In God we trust," it doesn't mean a damn thing to a Buddhist. I had a very amusing experience shortly after arriving in Honolulu. I was invited to give a talk in a church. Now, it was the church to which my wife's family was associated. And when I married Jean and went there, we went to that church. Well, I was brought up a Roman Catholic, and this was actually the first Protestant church service I'd ever experienced. It just seemed to me a kind of meeting, you know. There was no Blessed Sacrament. There was no God in the house, and so forth. Well, I was invited to give a talk to the very people of that church, you see, only a couple of years ago. And I had heard that they had been having some lectures on Buddhism. And they learned that the Buddhists don't believe in God. And so they wondered how they could have a spiritual life not believing in God. So I took that as my clue, and I started by saying that I had heard they just had that series of lectures. But when I first came to Hawaii, and my first experience of a Protestant service was that they didn't have God in the tabernacle. So the Protestants don't have God in the tabernacle, and the Buddhists don't have God in their vocabulary. So how could they have a religious, you know? The God image is a metaphor for a spiritual experience. And you don't have to get it through that particular metaphor. This was something that I thought was an amusing teaser.
Well, in some sense, we create our own gods.
Yes, that's exactly what we do. No matter what name we give it, the God that we have is the one we're capable of having. That's something people don't realize, that because they're all saying the same name for God, they don't have the same relationship to that or concept of what it is. And the concept of God is only a foreground of the experience. You know, well, there you are. There was this wonderful mystic, Meister Eckhart, you know, contemporary of Dante.
Who a number of Zen Roshis, by the way, have called very Buddhist.
Yes, in this sense. I found, as I was reading a sentence in one of his sermons, and the name of the sermon is On Riddance, Getting Rid Of. And he said, the ultimate riddance, and the most difficult, is the getting rid of your God to go to God. Wow. That's the big adventure, isn't it? That's the ultimate adventure. But that's just saying in big what you have to say every minute of your life to get rid of the life that you have planned in order to have the life that's waiting to be yours, you know, move into the transcendent. That's the whole sense of the adventure, I think.
Joseph, talking about creating our gods, what about our devils, our demons? The same process. In some sense, our gods become our demons, don't they?
My definition of a devil is a god who has not been recognized. That's to say, it's a power in you to which you have not given expression. And you push it back. And then, like all repressed energy, it builds up and becomes completely dangerous to the position that you're trying to hold. And so it's a threat. One of the best examples of that and the ambiguity of that is the trickster figure in American Indian, you know, Coyote and the rabbit, great yes. hair and all. He's at once a fool and a creator. And he's a fool in that he is not acting in terms of the order of life that is in being. And he's a creator in that he's a breakthrough, you know. And that's the unrecognized yet pressing energies that are threatening to break through. One of the obsessions, I think, in Christianity is the devil. When I turned from reading Oriental and tribal mythologies to any Orthodox Christian work, suddenly the devil is there. I think he's more important than God. He's the reason for all the wars against other people, you know. He justifies the massacre of primitive tribes. They're all devil worshippers. And anyone who has an experience of the divine that's not that of this particular clergy is worshiping a devil. And that's the word that's actually used for their gods throughout.
I like that story that the Tibetans talk about of when Padmasambhava came to Tibet and he was faced with all of these demons and evil deities of the bone tradition. Mm. He basically transformed them into protectors of the Dharma.
That's it.
And that's what we're really talking
about.
That's
an old mythological trick. The savior hero overcomes a demon. And that makes him the protector. There's a wonderful story of the Buddha, two incarnations before his last, when he was Prince Five Weapons. He had, as a young man, learned how to use five weapons. And he's riding home now, a triumphant young warrior prince. And out of a forest comes a great big demon, a great monster whose name is Sticky Hair. And the Buddha, the future Buddha, is threatened by this. And he throws at him his javelin, and the javelin sticks in his hair. Then he gets his bow and arrow, and he sends arrow after, and they all stick in his hair. Then he throws his discus, it sticks in his hair. He takes his sword, it sticks in his hair. He takes his club, it sticks in his hair. Then he hits him with his right fist, then his left, then kicks him with his right foot, then his left, and then butts him with his head. Do you recognize this? This is Br'er Rabbit with the tar baby. It's the same story. And so he's stuck. The demon says, I'll bet you're frightened now, boy. And he says, no, I'm not. Because I have that within me, a knowledge that will blow both of us to smithereens. And you're afraid of that. I'm not. So the demon said, okay. Lets him loose. So the Buddha had conquered Sticky Hair. And then what did he do? He made him the guardian of that wood. It's the recognition, the dealing with it, and then giving it its place. This place may be the same place it had, only you've recognized that place and its importance. Do you see what I mean?
And the relevance to that of in everyday practical life is that so often we tend to repress our demons and shove them into the closet, push them under the rug, and not deal with them.
Then that's what they become. They become the monster.
And so then the creative adventure, what could be the creative adventure, becomes the journey through hell.
That's right.
Why do you think it is that we continue to repress our demons and not allow them to, not deal with them?
Well, because they ask for a larger dimension in our lives than we're willing or able to give. I mean, it's important to hold a form and not just to blow. But in doing that, one should know what the powers are that are being asked to hold back, you know, because recognizing them is part of integrating them. And then the form that you're holding is held in relation to what it's not doing.